Welcome to Called to Create, an LDS PMA podcast where some of the best Latter-day Saint creators offer tips, tools, and inspiration to guide you in your creative journey. I'm your host, Connie Sokol. Welcome back. I'm Connie Sokol, your host of Called to Create, and this is my co-host,
Bryson Sokol.
That's right. We have a special treat for you because this time I was able to interview Brandon Moll, and he was so generous that my sweet son, who loves Brandon Moll, said he wanted to
meet him
and ask him some
questions.
That's right, which he did, and he was incredible. It was absolutely fantastic, and he asked the most perfect questions. And Brandon Moll was fantastic, a total gentleman in engaging in our impromptu interview. So we have our brand new, one-time-only co-host,
Bryson Sokol.
That's right, interviewing Brandon Moll, New York Times bestselling author. Check it out.
And you know what, Bryson, my younger brother's name is Bryson, so I already have this very positive association with you.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Plus, if you like the books, you're already my friend, so that's great.
All right, Bryson, take it away.
Well, the first question that I have is, what is it like in the daily life of an author?
Yeah, daily life. Like, probably, it's not very fancy. You know, but like every now and then it's a little bit fancy. I guess that's what it's like. So there's sort of different hats I wear as an author. A huge part of my year, I'm wearing the writer hat, which means I'm working on the book. And that is the least glamorous job of almost any job, because you are just alone in a room typing. You are just almost a total hermit. But sometimes I have to wear a promoter hat, right? Which is letting people know the book exists, or, you know, no one will ever read it if they don't know it exists. And so that is the busy part. And that keeps me from becoming a complete hermit, because that puts me in front of people a lot. So when I'm wearing my promoter hat, I might be doing presentations at libraries or bookstores. And I also might be doing assemblies at elementary schools or junior highs, or sometimes high schools, speaking at colleges, occasionally speaking at conferences, like big writers conferences, or places like Comic-Con or FanX. And all those things together, that suddenly you go from being this very private person to very public and in front of audiences and in front of crowds. And so it's sort of like jumping from the hot tub to the pool, back and forth. Like, you're either really unknown or really public, you know, which is sometimes whiplash for an author. The part that feels more natural to me is the alone part. You know, I think deep down I'm more introverted than extroverted, but I had to develop an extroverted side of my personality, or I couldn't do the promotional part.
That was a really good answer.
Yeah, that's the basics. I mean, that's what it looks like. And so being an author, if you don't want to get in front of people, it might not be the perfect job, you know, because otherwise no one will ever hear about your book, or it makes it really hard for people to hear about your book. But then also, if you can't stand being alone in a room for a long time typing, also, you know, might want to think twice, because that's a huge part of the job.
So true. Oh, man, that was a great answer.
Thanks.
Another question that I have is, what inspired you to write Fablehaven and your other books?
What inspired me to write Fablehaven? So there's a couple answers to this. Answer number one is, I was inspired by my favorite authors. So when I was a kid, I didn't even like to read a thick book until I found The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And for some reason, that idea of kids crossing to another world and having adventures, that really worked for me. And suddenly I saw, oh, this is why people read thick books, because sometimes they're awesome. You know, and when I say thick book, I mean versus a picture book. As a little kid, I didn't mind a picture book, but as I got older, I wasn't sure about thick books until I found some I liked. After Narnia kind of showed me how imaginative a fantasy could be, and then I read Lord of the Rings when I was a little older, and that showed me how a fantasy could feel almost like a real history, like it felt true and important, the things that happened in that story. And then older still, I read Harry Potter. That came out when I was in college. And reading the Harry Potter books showed me you could tell a story with a young main character, but make the story smart and twisty so a grown-up could like it too. And that helped define the kind of books I wanted to write. So if you look at my stories, most of them have young main characters, but a big adventure. Sometimes they're going to a portal to a fantasy world, like in Narnia. You know, mm-hmm. Often it's kids as heroes, like in Harry Potter. Often I try to build a rich, big fantasy world. I'm sure not quite as rich as Middle Earth was for Lord of the Rings, but that's always my goal. Is I want the book to feel really deeply imagined, and hopefully it feel like more realistic than you might expect. So my favorite books influenced me a lot. And then very specifically for Fablehaven, I used to live in Connecticut and my house was surrounded by trees. And I would daydream, what if there was monsters out in the woods who were going to like eat my little brothers and sisters? And I tried to think, well, how could that come true? And I thought, oh, what if there was secret wildlife parks? That's why we don't hear about them being in our world, is because they're hidden on these secret wildlife parks. And those were the first seeds of the idea of Fablehaven, which, you know, is about a worldwide network of secret wildlife parks for magical creatures.
So that's why it mainly takes place in Connecticut. That's very interesting.
Yeah, a lot of the time, if I'm going to have a setting in the real world, my preference is to set it someplace I've been or I've lived, because then I have sense memory to draw from as I create the location, the setting. I did that in Candy Shop War as well. When I was in fifth grade, my family moved to a town in Northern California called Clayton. And I took a lot of memories of that actual town to create the town Colson in the book. And then just added fantasy on top of the environment that I remember as a fifth grade kid. So I had sort of a blueprint of a town that I could base the setting on.
That is really, really cool. The last question that I have is, are you writing a book right now? And if so, will you give us a little sneak peek?
Yes, I am. And yes, I will. I am just finishing up, probably called the Guardian series, probably book one, Forbidden Mountain. None of that is official yet, right? It'll be three books. If I have a masterpiece in me, this might be it. I've been planning this for years. I'm almost done with book one. It's supposed to come out in fall of 2025. That's probably all I can say right now. It'll be with Penguin and Random House is who it's coming out with. Oh, and I have something else. There's even before that comes out, because that's still a ways away, I'm almost done writing it, but Random House has a really long lead time, you know, so like I turn it in and then it's a long time before it's published. But with a slightly shorter lead time, I'm also writing a book, a novel where Newell and Doran are the main characters from Fablehaven, the satyrs. And so it'll be like a Newell and Doran novel, an adventure that they go on. And that will be spring of 2025. So that'll be my next novel.
And I bet it's going to have a lot of comedy. I love those two.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the hope. Like they always make the scenes light and fun. They're fun characters to spend time with. And I think they're fun enough characters to spend time with that we could go on an adventure where they're the central characters. And I think I can make it fun. So we'll see. I'll try to prove that by writing a good book. That's the whole trick to this profession. Yeah.
That is beautiful. Oh my goodness.
I cannot wait. I can't either. Right there.
Oh, that makes me happy. Seeing your reaction makes me a little happier that I'm doing it, because I hoped this was something that some of the readers would go, oh yeah, that would be fun. Like, because to me, it seemed fun. So I'm glad if you're excited for it.
It's more than fun.
We can't wait. We're right there.
Oh, Chris, you guys are the best.
Thank you so much. Thanks for taking a few minutes. Any last thing?
Thank you for sharing.
Good talking to you, Bryson. Thanks. You had really good questions. Thank you.
Thanks so much. All right, I'm going to get him back to school. We're going to count this as like, you know, extracurricular credit for today.
Sure, I would. Yeah, right. You talk to an author, it's like career day or something.
That's right. Oh, yeah. That's exactly it. Yeah. Oh, they're going to be so jealous. All right, one moment. We'll be right back. Thank you again for allowing him that once in a lifetime. He is going to live on that for months. I know he went back to school and he's going to be like, you won't bully. So thank you.
Oh, that's funny. That's great. I'm glad if it was meaningful to him. That's awesome.
That was so fun to have my son be able to ask those questions, and I need to go ahead and switch the gears, and we're going to start with more of that official interview and give you the lowdown on Brandon Mall, and it is amazing. And I'm going to embarrass him for just a few minutes with the official bio, and then we're going to jump into the questions. Brandon Mall is the number one New York Times bestselling author of the Fablehaven, Dragon Watch, Beyonders, and Five Kingdoms series. A kinetic thinker, Brandon enjoys bouncy balls, squeezable stress toys, and popping bubble wrap, my son as well. He lives in Utah in a happy little valley near the mouth of a canyon with his wife, Erlyn, their 11 children, and three mischievous cats. And Brandon loves meeting his readers and hearing about their experiences with his books. We are so excited to chat today, so let's dive right in. And I want to go back to that beginning of like when you did write Fablehaven and everything that started off with rejection, like a good author does, right? Any good story. So can you talk to us about that of starting out? You have this great idea and you know how that feels. I've written books too, but not like you. But you know, you get all excited. It's your baby. You're like, this is going to be the best thing ever. And then those rejections start coming in. Talk to me about that experience, because then you actually met with Chris and something good happened out of that. But Talk to us about how you were feeling when you were putting that out, and then what happened with the rejection and what made you keep going.
Okay, yeah, sure. If you talk to a bunch of authors, what you'll often hear is, boy, it was really hard to get started. And then a funny thing happened. And that funny thing that happened or whatever, you know, like that little coincidence or good moment that sometimes is like 7 years in the making or 10 years in the making, you know, like you put in years of effort to try to be in the right place at the right time for somebody to say yes, you know, and for something to get started. For me, I started out writing short fiction. One of my premises was I could write a lousy short story or I could write a lousy novel. So let's write some lousy short stories, you know, not trying to make them lousy, of course, but just realizing I was in a training ground phase of my career. And so I wrote a lot of short fiction. My premise was if I can write a good scene, I can write a good book. And so if you write short fiction, that's just less scenes, right? But it's the same skill set of one scene after another telling a good story, right? And I feel like the unit of story that we're all trying to master if we write fiction is writing a good scene. And so I tried to practice writing good scenes by writing short fiction. The best I ever did was getting an honorable mention in the Writers of the Future contest, which was hard won because I got lots and lots of short fiction I sent out to magazines and contests and just never heard a thing. To get a nomination for that Writers of the Future contest was a little like flicker in the dark. The honorable mention didn't really come with anything. That's a contest where if you get like first, second, or third, your thing gets published and you get some prize money. And that never happened for me. So if I looked at my short story writing career up until then, it didn't go very well. And then I wrote my first novel. After I graduated from college, the gift my newlywed bride gave to me was that, hey, write a novel. We don't have kids yet. There's a little gap here.
Do it now.
Yeah. And so I did. I was like, you know what? That's a gift. And so she worked a normal job. I worked a speculative job, which was writing this novel, right? And I got it done. And pretty soon we had a kid. And so like my window closed at the end of a novel, right? But I got a novel written and I submitted. And the most dreaded thing happened, which is that I heard nothing for years. And it wasn't even a no, right? It was just nothing. And that hearing nothing is so demoralizing because it feels like, was it shredded unopened? Did it even see it? But at least the rejection means someone opened it up, you know, like opened the envelope. You're like, I spent a year on this. That first novel was called The Other End of the Hippo, which is what evolved into my Beyonders series. But back then it was just The Other End of the Hippo and I could not get a nibble. But I did show it to one guy who is Chris Schobinger at Shadow Mountain. And this was late in the game. I felt like I'd shown it to everybody already, but I had only been thinking East Coast publishers because that's where most of the publishing world was. Shadow Mountain wasn't so much of a thing back then. It was very new. And so when I caught wind of Shadow Mountain, I was like, well, I might as well try there. And I finally found an editor who brought me in and sat me down and he still gave me a no, but at least it wasn't a non-answer no. You know, like he brought me in, he sat me down, he said, hey, we're not going to publish this. You know, it's like, okay, well, thanks for the eye contact with the rejection, you know, but the reason he did the eye contact was because he was like, but we like how you write. Like we see potential in how you write. If you have something, he goes, this one you did just isn't quite a fit for what we're after. But if you show us something else, and he said, do you have other ideas? Do you have other concepts? And I mentioned, I had an idea of a story about a secret wildlife preserve for magical creatures. And he's like, now, see, that's almost exactly the kind of thing we're looking for. But part of this was paying attention to what publishers are saying. Because when he said, okay, we like this premise, I said, well, it's time to write another novel. And so nights and weekends, because I was working a day job writing marketing stuff, nights and weekends, I cranked out Fablehaven in about 5 months and then turned that into him. And when he saw it, that got accepted right away. So kind of long story short, or long story, there's no making this short at this point. But the end of the story is that Fablehaven got accepted the first place I showed it. After I did a ton of legwork with other stuff, failing until I finally kind of found someone who paid attention to me enough to potentially accept something. And after Fablehaven got published, within a year, I was able to quit my day job and I've written full-time ever since. That was 2006.
Oh, that is every writer's dream, right? That whole thing of, you know, they always say, don't quit your day job because it's going to take years. And for you to be able to find that fit. And I love that you bring up the point, Brandon, that it was so much rejection and that was practice. that's what was happening with that first novel.
The first novel, yeah. That was all like training camp, practice ground.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And there's purpose in that. I remember Jennifer Nielsen talking about, she had written, was it The Sorcerer's Apprentice? And she was just sure this was going to be a bestseller. And same thing, so much rejection. But then she took pieces of that. And that's what became her first bestseller, her New York Times bestselling book. So not to give up on that, but to look for the opportunities, the pieces, and not be so set on how it should look or what you think it should look like to miss the opportunity before you. Love this so much. Let's go back a little bit to where you got these ideas, because I know you said when you were young, you were a daydreamer, kind of irritated teachers, I'm sure, maybe parents sometimes, but you had all these stories and ideas. And I think sometimes as we get older, we don't give credence to that. We don't value that. We just think, oh, well, that was fluff. That was back in the day. But you didn't write your first novel until after college. Any thoughts or suggestions for people who, especially listening, that are writers or the creatives that we have as our audience, of how to capture and keep harnessing that creative part of us, which we tend to lose in the functionality of the daily dues?
You know, I think you can kind of murder your imagination. You let adulthood do it. You let the rat race do it. You know, you get busy and maybe you stop daydreaming, or maybe you consider that part of putting away childish things.
Yeah.
Right. And it is one of the greatest resources that individuals and humanity has is imagination. There's nothing around you in your house that isn't the product of someone else's imagination. Right? Something that didn't exist until someone thought it up and said, what about this? You know, and that's, I'm talking electricity. I'm talking art on your walls. I'm talking a house to live in. You know what I mean? Like someone said, you know what? We put some sticks together. This is better than a cave. You know, and that evolved into the Taj Mahal. And without looking at the possible and thinking what might be, you're stuck where you are. And so this faculty of imagination is really powerful. You know, what if Einstein had shelved his imagination, or what if, you know, any of our great thinkers or scientists or artists had shelved their imagination, there would be a hole in our society with stuff that they produced, right? And so number one is remembering, hey, your imagination is a very powerful faculty and a huge asset if you harness it. The way I describe it for myself is harnessing the crazy. Because an imagination unbridled takes you all over the place, especially as a little kid. You know, like it made me a very distractible student. In some ways, if I were your employee today, whoever you are watching, I would be your highly distracted employee, right? Like living in my head, one foot in this world, one foot in fairyland or whatever's going on in my mind. And I did learn that if you harness it and embrace it, there's huge benefit there. As a kid, my imagination would meander all over the place. As I got older and wanted to write my own stories, I would start paying attention to the places I daydreamed about that became like a playground in my head. Places that I looked forward to returning to time and again. And the more I thought about them, the richer they became and the more time I wanted to spend there. Because my premise was, if I am enjoying it that much that I want to go back in, maybe other people will feel the same way. That is the barometer I've used my whole life. So I think sometimes unbridled daydreaming of just really random, that's like a finding mode, right? But once you find something where you see lots of value, and this extends beyond stories. For me, this is about stories. But if for somebody else, it might be envisioning the perfect go-kart or envisioning some sort of sculpture that they're like, wow, why has no one ever done this before? This seems obvious. Like this would be the coolest sculpture ever, right? For me, it's, why hasn't anyone written this story before? This seems like an awesome place. It needs to exist. It needs to be shared. And so once I see that, then I set about the task of very focused daydreaming, of really trying to learn that story world and those characters and see if I can develop it to a place where it's a movie in my mind that I would not want to miss and that I would dedicate a year of my life to sharing with people if that's what it takes, right?
I love that. A movie in my mind that I wouldn't want to miss. That is so good, and a place you want to keep returning to. Love that permission to do that. In fact, I think it was Albert Einstein who said, creativity is imagination having fun. I think that is the crux of what makes life enjoyable, is that we have the capacity to be creative and to have that outlet for that expression. So as you're talking about this, I can only imagine the beautiful spaces in your mind that you go to. That's a lot of creative juice. And you have put, if I have that right, 4 series, which is 18 books on the New York Times bestseller list. I mean, it's unbelievable what you've been able to do in this imagination. That's so prolific. That's a lot of creativity. Has there ever been a time when the well has run dry, when you're like, I just don't have it right now? Has there been a time for you where it just sort of dried up?
Yeah. The time when it most dried up was during my divorce, because I was just so emotionally crippled by the whole thing. It wasn't something that I necessarily wanted, but my wife at the time felt like had to happen. And so, yeah, I mean, I was destroyed. I was dead inside for a while. And I remember telling my publishers, hey, if I was a construction worker and I had broken my spine, you wouldn't be expecting me into work for a couple of days or a couple of weeks. And I was like, I am a writer. And right now my mind is broken. Like I can't think straight. And so just everything got pushed back because in that amount of pain, the well was dry. Otherwise, for me, the well of making up ideas that I don't want to like jinx it, but it overflows. I've got more ideas than I will ever use. I'll go to my grave with probably hundreds of unwritten novels, at least hundreds of unexplored concepts. And that hasn't been the problem. What does become the problem for me is within a certain project, sometimes I'll get stuck, right? Like, and it tends to have to do with transitions, like to create smooth transitions from one scene to the next, that chain of scenes that leads the reader through the book. Sometimes I don't see the next link in that chain, right? Sometimes I get stuck. I've got a million ideas, but none of them are the next link in this chain in a satisfying way. And for me, writer's block, that whole experience, I treat it like it's an early warning signal that what I'm writing is going in the wrong direction.
It's not fitting. Yeah.
It's sort of like myself not loving it, right? And if I'm not loving it, heaven help the reader. You know, because this is my baby, right? I'm supposed to love it. It's my baby. But like, if I don't love it, how am I going to get the reader? Hey, you should love my baby, right?
Yes.
And so when I'm in writer's block, I go, where have I gone wrong? Is this scene the wrong scene? Often the answer is there's not enough trouble. I need to make this harder on the characters. It's boring because it's not eventful enough. I need to make this more interesting. So it's either skip this boring scene, cut ahead to where things are more interesting, or find some trouble to make this scene more lively. You know, sometimes it's just kill that, take a walk, think hard, start fresh, or don't think hard and go back and start fresh. That gets me through my writer's blocks or the places where I feel kind of, I don't know what to do next. So often it's a transition. So often it's knowing a scene en route to the scenes I want to get to.
So good. I just love that you have found your rhythm and paying attention to those signals as a writer so that, like you said, you can take all of these ideas and this talent, this ability, this capacity, and then get it on the page in a way that the readers can receive it. Now, I know that you do a lot schools and assemblies and like talking to these younger kids who are your audience. When you do that, do you teach them about writing like this, or do you just inspire them to read? What's kind of the focus when you're getting to meet with your audience?
Yeah, when I go into schools, every writer on earth should high five me because I'm trying to grow the pie for everybody. I'm trying to get kids to see the value in putting reading on the entertainment menu, right? Mm-hmm. So my primary goal is I'm trying to flip some reluctant readers into reading. I'm trying to give them rational, sane arguments for why, hey, like if you enjoy movies or if you enjoy TV shows or if you enjoy video games, reading should be on that list. It should be on the entertainment menu because that experience of building a story in your mind as you read words gives you a slightly different and in some ways slightly richer entertainment experiences than all the other media. And so like, if you're someone who likes a good story and you're not reading, you're missing some of the very best entertainment experiences where you feel so drawn into the story because it's happening inside you, right? You're customizing it in your mind. And that's a concept that all readers understand. But if you're not a big reader yet, that concept might be hard to glimpse, right? So I'm trying to paint that picture. And so I talk about reading, and then I talk about why we create stuff and encourage them to be creative. And I get specific about writing since that's the way I create professionally. But I also throw it out there pretty wide, you know, reminding them, hey, like it's artists and inventors. And a lot of the people that influence our society are the people who expand their creative gifts. And the way that happens is you find your creative hobbies and you stick with them, because time plus a creative hobby equals a stronger imagination and greater ability at that hobby. And I make the point, you know, if you get really good at your creative hobby, that could be your job someday. And then your job is something that you would theoretically do for fun. I mean, that's kind of what I'm bringing. I'm definitely trying to teach. I'm trying to hit hard, be like a cheerleader for reading and be a cheerleader for creating. And I've done thousands of visits. And so I've got the visits nice and tight. I do a good job at it. I usually get some reluctant readers that'll flip. Often now, because I've been doing this for almost 20 years, I will be doing a book signing and adults and kids come up and say, hey, you're the reason I got into reading, because I gave them the cheerleader speech. And then I gave them a book that was reasonably fun to read, often Fable Haven or Candy Shop or, you know, one of my series. And they go, hey, it actually is kind of fun. And so I get these adults that will come and say, hey, you're the reason. I get an embarrassment of riches with that comment. And it's super meaningful to me, because it would mean the world to me if I could say that to C.S. Lewis. He changed my life by making me learn to love reading. And so when I could serve that purpose for someone, it's like, whoa, it's like, it's humbling, it's exciting, it puts wind in my sails to keep writing good stuff.
So good. And it's that pay it forward principle. I love that. Has there been a moment, I'm sure there's so many, but has there been a moment at one of these places? I mean, you've gone to Russia, China, Poland. I think Fable Haven's required reading in Poland. I mean, like, yeah, wow, the influence is incredible. But when you've gone to all these things, is there an experience or a moment that stands out with one of these kids or one of these adults that comes to mind where the reading really mattered to them?
Yeah, I was at a conference in Poland, and there was a young girl, a teen girl, who came up and said, I think the quote was, you write for legends and geniuses. She was saying, I consider myself, you know, a future legend and a genius, and your work appeals to people like me. And that was one of the highest, best compliments I ever got from anybody. I still remember it.
And having that impact, I always say it just takes one book. And I had 7 kids and a bunch of them did not want to read, the boys especially. But if they got that one book, that Fable Haven, that Candy Shop, or if they got that one book, they were off and running. And that's the sweet little Bryson that you just saw there. Man, he did not want to really read it, but then Fable Haven, and he's off and running. And now
did the trick,
Yep. And he's in the car and in his room and, oh, just a minute, Mom. And that is everything, especially to parents. I want to switch gears for just a second, because I know our time is wrapping up. I'm so sad, but I'm thinking about those listening, especially writers and creatives in general. We have all of this beautiful creativity, but then we have to switch the gears and put on the hat, like you talked about, and promote and do the business side and all of those things. What do you have a tip or a tool that you learned along the way? What did you learn about being able to balance those two and step in to that other role that's just as important if you want to get your things out there?
There's a quote that I like that's, nobody grows up until they have to. And it's true in different phases of life, right? You know, if you indulge a kid and let him lounge, yeah, who wouldn't kind of like that life, you know? And if you're stuck in a situation where, hey, to make life work, I need a job, then yeah, you get a job. And so a lot of writers, I think we would love to be sort of Peter Pan and just live in our Neverland story worlds. But if you've got a family, or if you're just trying to be self-sufficient, you got to make some money with the thing, or it really limits the amount of time you can do it. And writing is a beautiful thing, because it can be a hobby your whole life. It does not have to be a day job that provides your primary income. It can be a side thing, or it can be something you don't even make money at, and then that you just do for the pleasure of creating stuff, right? Like, there's a lot of things we create for pleasure that we don't think, oh, we have to monetize this. But if you're trying to make a living at it, and if you want to be able to write more hours in a day, it helps if that's how you make your living, because suddenly, you know, 8 hours a day at least are devoted to writing. And so if you want that life, if you want to be making money at it, you got to take a hard look at what does it take to make money at it. And part of that is, look, you're either a self-published person who really attacks the marketing and figures out how to market that book, where you are both writer and publisher, which to me is a very hard job and also doable, but hard, right? Or you go the more maybe traditional route of having a publisher. And in that case, you're trying to get a really good agent and be smart about who you pick and someone that you want representing you. And you're trying to make deals with publishers that you think will be a good partner for marketing your book. And if that turns out to be true, that you find a publisher who's a partner at marketing your book, you throw all your weight behind it, everything you can do to help that go. You know, just having a publisher doesn't mean that you're going to be their top priority. And certainly your book will not be as important to them as it is to you, almost inevitably, no matter how successful you become. And so if you're not your own number one promoter, you know, especially with self-publishing, but even when you're traditional publishing, if you're not your own number one promoter, you might be in trouble. You will lose out to people who care more. And so what does that look like? What it looks like is play to your strengths. Figure out what you do well that seems to have an impact on sales. Are you really talented online? Are you great at making funny, silly, cool, draws attention TikTok videos or YouTube videos? Or are you really great on Instagram, posting great photos and captions and short videos? Or like, if you're really strong in any of that stuff, that can really help. Are you really good in person? When you get in front of an audience, do you leave them going, yeah, I'm going to check that out? If you get in front of a bunch of kids in a school, do they show up at the book signing, right? You try everything as best you can. You pay attention to what works and you play to your strengths to try to help that along. At the end of the day, a book will sell because of word of mouth. That is why a book sells. But word of mouth needs a chance to start. And so you want to send out as many sparks as you can in the ways that make sense, in the ways that are your strengths. And if you don't have any strengths, find some. And you send out sparks as best you can. And if the word of mouth is good on the book, eventually those sparks will start a fire. And if the word of mouth isn't good on the book, that's not necessarily that you did anything bad, but it also means that almost no matter how many sparks you give, that thing's not going to go. But you try to give everything a fair chance. You push, push, push until it pulls you along, until the word of mouth kicks in. That very clearly happened on Fablehaven. Very early on, no one had ever heard of me. It was my first novel. No one had ever heard of the book. Schools were like, who's this guy? You know, like as you come in, you feel sort of like the snake oil salesman, you know, where everyone's kind of looking at you with a suspicious eye. And so you try a really good job to make the presentation very educational and not too self-promotional and be a professional and try to one by one start making good impressions. And I started making good impressions at schools. As schools talk to other schools, they'd say, hey, yeah, you should have that guy. Like the kids liked it. The teachers liked it. He does a good job. And you slowly start building reputation. They crack the book open. Hey, what? Happy surprise. The book's actually fun. You know, there was pushing, 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 pushing on with Fablehaven until at some point things tipped. And then it was pulling me along. And whether I did bookstores or not, or whether I did schools or not, that thing was spreading to places I'd never been and selling in ways that shocked everybody. And so that's always what you're trying to do. You never know for sure what's going to work. I've never had a series totally tank, but I have definitely had some hit better than others. And you can't predict it. They're all me doing my best job and making a book and a series that I thought were really cool. And for some reason, some have the special sauce and they just get extra word of mouth and they just really stick in people's minds. And so you just do your best to create it. Then you do your best to promote it. And then you live with the results, right?
Such good points. I love that it's not just this A plus B equals C for some special chosen people, that this point of just keep doing your best, keep showing up, and then watch, learn, observe, practice, rinse and repeat, right? Those things. And then be ready to adjust. Because I think sometimes, especially creatives, we can start clinging onto, but this is so good. And they don't want to kill their little darling, so to speak. But it's that ability to go, okay, this isn't, but this is, let's go with this. And that's the mark of a professional. That's someone who can say, I can be objective even about something that's born of my soul, kind of a feel.
Yeah, I'm paying attention to what is performing in the marketplace. Yeah. I'm paying attention to what is working and doing my best to generate stuff that I feel like is cool and that I'm proud of, but that also seems to be connecting with people.
And connects. And that really leads to a point that I'd love to bring up, that I remember Josie Kilpack talking about. She had submitted her first book and she knew it was going to be fantastic. It was going to totally go big. And then she came home and opened up the package and it was a rejection and they had sent it back even. And she was like, how is that possible? I was just at the temple. Like, I'm doing all the things. So I want to talk about faith for a minute, because just because we're being faithful doesn't mean we're going to be successful in our creative endeavors. And also there is such a huge part to play with faith and being able to drive what we're doing and stay in the game and keep showing up when it doesn't look like we should. What has faith done for you? What part has that played for you all along this journey?
I've got two stories I can tell you. So story number one is this. I had written that book called The Other End of the Hippo. I'd put my heart and soul into it. I thought it was really cool. I was sharing it around. I was getting nothing, right? Remember, like not even no's, just nothing. And I remember there was a point, I was married and I was planning to have a family. And I was like, you know, at some point, I got to do what will provide for the family. And if this is never going to provide for the family, then this needs to gradually become relegated to a side thing. And I had a prayer where I really pleaded with God. It wasn't even a prayer of like, make it happen. It was a prayer of like, will this happen? Am I kidding myself? You know what I mean? It was that prayer. It was like, yeah. It was like, am I on a good path here? Like, or am I deluding myself? Am I imagining I'm Steven Spielberg when really I'm making home movies? You know, it was that kind of prayer.
Great.
Yeah. And I've got this really distinct, clear answer that it would be published. And it just felt really clear. And in my life, I've learned that as I approach God, sometimes it's sort of like being in a prison cell and knocking on the walls and trying to hear if someone taps back, because the dialogue, are you even real? A, are you hearing me? B, like
you taps. Yeah.
All these things, right? But I had had experiences where he had tapped back, right? And the simplest form of communication that I've had with God, and it was in my earlier, younger years, it was the only communication I had with God, was just sometimes getting a yes, confirming answer to things. I wanted to know if it was true, or confirming answer to a choice that I thought made sense. In this instance, I got a very clear yes, this book would be published. Mm-hmm. Now, asterisks. Instantly, my mortal mind, my conscious brain started saying, oh, well, you know what? All my troubles are over. I got that answer and we're good to go. And so imagine my disappointment as a week goes by and a month goes mm-hmm. by and a year goes by and multiple years go by and that book doesn't get published. And you start going, is my communication off? Is my communication wrong? So here's story two. Story two is that I have my first kid coming, and the first kid coming means this is the end of being a full-time writer for now. Because full-time writer was an unpaid full-time writer, right? And I can't be the house husband guy who's got kids now and is not helping with the income, right? And so I didn't want to do that and felt a temptation to do that. Like a little more time and it might work, you know, like that kind of temptation. And so I had gotten a job substitute teaching on the Navajo Reservation in Southern Utah. I had gotten the job. I had not started the job. I was in a place called Navajo Mountain. You have to go through Arizona to get there. Deep, deep Southern Utah. In kind of, you know, middle of nowhere compared to like Salt Lake City or civilized world. And all I wanted was just a confirmation that it was a good thing to do, because that my baby was going to be born down there. And it was 45 minutes to a gas station, hour and a half to a grocery store. You know, you could run out of gas going to get gas, right? And so I just wanted a confirmation that this was good. My wife was on board. I was on board. It seemed like a kind of a neat adventure to go do this, right? And I could not get that yes. I could not get that yes that I knew. Couldn't get it. Midnight comes and goes. After midnight, I flipped the question. Am I not supposed to do this? Yes, you're not supposed to do it. The one thing I knew how to hear, yes, you know, like, am I not supposed to do it? Yes, you're not supposed to do it. And I was like, okay, wait, you know, like this was months in the making. I have no job history because I spent a year after college just writing. So I look like this unemployable guy almost, maybe, you know, and I had a job and it was like, what, you just want me not to work? You want me to be the house? Like, what do you want here? So I woke up my wife first thing and said, hey, you got to pray about this too, because this affects us both. I was like, am I wrong here? And she prayed and she's like, yeah, no, I feel the same thing. I think you're not supposed to. And I was like, is something just going to come along? And I felt, yes. And I wasn't even praying at that moment. So the next day, sometimes after inspiration like that, the next day you're like, was that real? You know, because I'm about to burn a bridge here because of my inkling in the night. But you know what? If I'm going to ask God, am I going to be that fool who asks him, gets an answer, and then disregards it? You know, I'd done that once before because it didn't make sense to me. And I got royally burned. And so I was like, okay, like be sane. You asked, you got an answer, carry it out, live it out, right? Be true to it. So I called up the guy and I felt embarrassed. I called up the guy and said, I'm so sorry. My circumstances have changed. You know, you're going to have to go with somebody else. You sent me this contract and everything. I'm really sorry. I can't do it. A few weeks later, I get a call from an old friend, wants me to come work at Excel Entertainment doing marketing, LDS movies. It was in Salt Lake City area, independent films, right? And I didn't have to pray about it. I didn't have to think about it. When he called up and said, hey, do you want this job? The spirit was like, yep. Or like my own nature was like, yep. And so I start working there. And I worked there for 2 or 3 years, felt like a surgeon in a butcher shop. In this sense, I was a surgeon because in my mind, I should be the guy making the content, not the guy writing blurbs. Yeah, like I'm the blurb writer. I want to be the creator, you know?
Yes.
And so in some ways, it was a nightmare, almost like teasing me, putting me really close to what I wanted to be doing, but I wasn't the guy, right? And at the same time, it was like being like the old-timey CEOs who are like, I've done every job at the company. You know what I mean? I started in the mailroom. I worked my way up. And like, it was that because I was learning the promotional side of entertainment. I was learning so many things about marketing, which is invaluable and that I use every day, you know, or very frequently. But at the time I was like, what is going on? What is going on? But that job at Excel led directly to the connection that got me in front of Chris Schobinger, which led directly to my publishing career. If I had been on a Navajo reservation in Arizona, I might've been having interesting experiences, but I might've been 600 miles away from where I needed to be to have that publishing thing work out at the right time, at the right publisher, in the right way. Because for some reason, that little mix of Shadow Mountain right then at that time for me was my golden ticket. Everything just opened up and it's been 20 years of weird amounts of success starting there. And so here's where I bring this all together, right? I know this is kind of a long story, but what brings this all together is this. I heeded that prompting to not go to the Navajo reservation. That led directly, like I can only thank God for it, to being in the right place at the right time for my writing career to start. After I published Fable Haven, we co-published with Simon & Schuster. They did the paperbacks, Shadow Mountain did the hardbacks. We had big publisher clout along with small publisher attention. It was a really good mix for me. I couldn't have scripted it better, basically. Like it was like magic. And Simon & Schuster says, hey, what's your next thing? We want to do your next thing. And I said, well, I've got this old thing that I wrote, you know, this Beyonder series, this Other End of the Hippo. And they said, yeah, let's take a look at it. They wanted a huge revision, which it did need. I started blank and rewrote the whole book, right? Some new main characters, a lot of things changed. A lot of things retained, some of the best ideas and moments. It is the same story, just with some really smart elements added in and some things changed around. That book, which was the book that I got a prompting would be published, debuted at number one on the New York Times list, which did not seem possible. God took a while to fulfill the promise, but when he did, it was so much better than I could have thought. I would have said, you fulfilled your promise if it got printed with a 500 book run at a small publisher. But when he fulfilled his promise, it got published by Simon & Schuster and was number one on the New York Times list. And let me add New York Times bestselling author to my resume. I have a huge confidence in God. And I really attribute any of my success that matters to stuff that he helped me plan. Now, it is possible that he does not want you to be a writer. It is possible. It is possible that he will make sure you're a writer. All those things are possible. I think your job is to stay very open to where he wants to lead you. Because if he leads you somewhere else other than being a writer, it will be better. It will be better. It will be like, in hindsight, it'll be like, yeah, writing was great, but he put me on a better path for me in my life, right? I trust that he knows me better than I know myself. And I trust that he can orchestrate successes that I could never dream of. And my job is to just try to look to him and listen as best I can. And I am imperfect at it. But the times when I've succeeded at it, in hindsight, have led to some of my greatest successes.
Gorgeously said, so perfectly put, and just trusting, like you said, that he knows where he needs you most, and go with that, and then do your very best and keep showing up. So fantastic. So many gems today, Brandon. I wish we had like another hour. So many stories that I know that you could be sharing. So I know people are going to want to connect with you, just like my son wanted to, as soon as possible. What's the best way for them to reach you?
The most obvious places, you can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter or X. You can find me on Instagram. Those outlets are places where I put out some general information. I'll put out information about where the next books are coming from, little tidbits about life, little tidbits about writing sometimes. And sometimes I do check comments and stuff. So if you reach out to me there, those are decent places. You can also, for general information, you can go to brandonmull.com. But in general, that's how you reach me. If you're signed up to follow me on the outlets I just named, I do book signings when I'm in a season of a book coming out. I do a bunch of book signings. I love interacting with my readers. If you ever want to talk to me, if you have questions about writing, track me down at a signing, talk to me after a signing, go find me when I'm doing a book conference. I'm really happy to talk to people about stuff. I'm really happy to interact both about the stories and about the job as a writer.
So true. You are so accessible and approachable, and so appreciate that. Brandon, this has just been phenomenal. And I love your candor talking about the difficulty of divorce and the joy of being able to remarry and have this family of 11 kids and being able to.
Yeah, you know that. Huh? Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
I'm like fodder for the next 20 books, right? I mean, talk about an adventure right in your home. It's just beautiful how this winding road of being a writer, how he's taken you and led you and you've gone with it and where you are now and turning back. And I think I just want to wrap up with one last bit of advice if you have for writers or creatives. As you are now standing here and looking back and seeing young Brandon Mull and all the uncertainty and all of the ins and outs and in between, the good, the bad, and the ugly, is there any one last thought that you want to share?
Yeah, I'll give you a couple. God cares about your desires. When I said that bit about go where God leads you, that is true. And always do it if you're wise. He also cares about your desires. And so if this is something that matters to you, then show him it matters to you and make an investment every day in helping it succeed. God can do a lot with a little. It's almost his pattern, right? Give me a few loaves of fishes and I can feed 5,000. He doesn't usually do that with nothing. He doesn't say, give me nothing and I'll feed 5,000, right? So if you do a little every day, if you do something towards your goal every day, you give God something to work with, something for him to build on. If you want to get healthy, if you want to get physically fit, give him something every day. This is true and this is powerful if you do that, right? Also, I mean, even if the offering is small, sometimes the offering will be big. But if you give him something every day toward what you want, he takes note of that. And if you pray for something and really want something badly and then live as if you're sincere, he takes note of that, right? The other thing, if I could talk to my young self, I would say, Brandon, give yourself time to improve. Trust that if you love this, that you will improve. And even if you're not Steven Spielberg yet, even if you're not even a very good writer yet, if you love it, give yourself time and you can grow into being a good writer if you love it and really care about telling good stories. So I would tell myself that. Give yourself time. You don't have to succeed tomorrow. I would tell myself, hey, stay really open, read a lot and write a lot and let the process of time multiply your gifts. And I would say this, I would say, tell stories that you want your name attached to. Tell stories that put some light into the world. That's really important. It's become increasingly important to me the more I've matured in my career. That doesn't mean telling stories that are hokey. It just means that the net effect of the story puts some light into the world. It's very easy to do the opposite. To me, when I think about what I want my name on and when I think about what impact I want to make on the world, I think, if anything, I want to try to nudge it up instead of nudge it down. That's a governing principle for me as I create stories. And sometimes my stories have totally gross stuff, totally scary stuff, but I want the net effect to be a little more light than darkness. That's my advice.
So good. I'm resisting the urge to write down these quotables. I'll have to go back and write them when I rewatch. You're funny. So good. Thank you so much for spending time with us today, sharing your life experience, your wisdom, and your stories, and just the goodness and the light that you put into the world. And so appreciate you sharing this time with us today to be able to inspire those that are listening right now. Thank you.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to have places to share about all this crazy stuff. It's kind of a weird life, but I'm happy to share about it.
Oh, it's so good and so inspiring. And for every creative, not just writers, and for those of you that are listening, if you've enjoyed this interview as much as I have, so powerful, we invite you to go back and listen to the other interviews that are available from so many different walks of life, artists, Kirk Richards and other authors, Scott Savage, and you have Jennifer Nielsen, you have musicians and filmographers and all kinds of people who have taken the time to share their journey on being called to create to help you on your journey. of being called to create.